We're going to start here, 9 lines up on the bottom, Lamed Aleph Amud Bet. We're just going to go over the sugi again. We ran through it just to finish, and now we're just going to go through it with a little more detail. So we were discussing the position of Rav Nachman, who allowed Beit Din to reverse their position, and didn't worry about the fact that that might lead to a ziluta de Beit Din, that might cause aspersions to be cast on the integrity of the Beit Din if they're going to switch their psak halacha. Because Rava had challenged him, and successfully challenged him and showed him that we don't believe that. The Gemara then concluded that Rav Nachman did this because he was someich on these Tanaim. And then we brought the following Mishnah, the Tanan. Rav Yehuda Omer, Ein Malin Lekuna Al Pi Eidechad. Rav Yehuda says that a person who we have questions about is Yichus, a single aid can't come and define for us or be machshir for us this individual that he should be considered or classified as a Kohen. Amar Rav Elazar, when is that true? When there are certain questions that are raised about the yichus of this individual. Where there is no questions about the yichus of this individual, a single aid would suffice in that situation. A single aid is sufficient in order to give someone classification of Kohen. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Hainu Rabbi Elazar. Gemara says, what's the difference between Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar? They both say that an Eid Echad works. If you want to suggest that when there is a single Eid that is casting aspersions on this individual's Yichus, then that's their argument, whether an Eid Echad can kind of overcome this Eid, or can an Eid Echad even overcome two Eidim that come along and cast aspersions on this individual? That we would suggest, or Belazar Sabar Arar Chad, only when there's a single aid questioning the ichus of this individual do we then say that another aid or single aid can overcome that problem. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Sabar Arar Trey, that even when you have two aidim, they come and question the ichus of this individual, a single aid can come back and be makshir him or clarify the situation. Vamer Rabbi Yochanan, Divrei Hakol in Arar Pachot Mishnayim. Didn't Rabbi Yochanan already established that when questions arise about the ichus of an individual, we don't accept or we don't even qualify the questions unless they come from two individuals. So, as the Balei Tosafot point out over here, near the Ri, the Rabbi Yochanan Iker Dvarav Ahach Mishna Itmar. Rabbi Yochanan's position is on this Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan says Divrei Hakol. What do you mean Divrei Hakol? Divrei Hakol means our Mishnah. The Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar, anybody who thinks that Arar bringing up questions about the ichus of an individual agrees that you need a minimum of two people to raise doubts about the ichus of this individual. El Arar Trey. So it must be a case where that the situation evolved because there were two Eidim raising doubts about this individual. And now this is the case, it's a little bit of a convoluted case. Kagon. He was a Kohen because his father was a Kohen. That's the famous joke. The individual wanted to become a Kohen and went to the rabbi and was trying to get him to qualify him as a Kohen. And the rabbi finally asked him, why do you want to be a Kohen so badly? He says, because my father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen. So here, the person's father is a Kohen. So in terms of Yichus, we know for certain that he comes from a lineage of Kohanim. But there were rumors that began to circulate that there were problems with his mother. That his mother was not a woman who was appropriately married to a Kohen, someone that is illegal or illicit for a Kohen to marry. The child born of that relationship is a Kohen Halal, which disqualifies him for any service as a Kohen or acting in a Kohen, as a Kohen in any way. So that's what caused the problem or raised doubts about the ichus of this individual. So in one sense, he has a chazaka that he's a Kohen because of his father and his family. On the other side, we have these rumors circulating that are causing a problem. Because of these rumors, we worry about whether he really is authentically a Kohen. Vachtine. And then we deposed him as a Kohen. So now, in terms of being deposed over here, question is, why did they depose him? Why did they remove him from the kihuna? We just said before that in terms of arar, when you want to raise doubts, you need a minimum of two edim. So what you see from here, and Tosfo points this out, is that a kol, a rumor that is persistent, is more problematic than an eid echad. If an Eid Echad showed up and raised doubts about the individual, we wouldn't take heed. We wouldn't listen to it. On the other hand, this rumor successfully causes doubts or raises doubts about this individual, and we depose him as a Kohen because of a rumor. Now again, there's certain rules about the rumors. We saw this before, again, that there are certain rules about rumors in terms of their persistence, in terms of whether this person's had an altercation with someone else in the city that might have precipitated the problem, but there are qualifications. But assuming that the rumor is circulating, and we can't find the source of the rumor, we don't know why it started, it's just information that is known out there, then that is enough to depose this Kohen. That's one possibility. The Balei HaTosafot over here suggest that it was not the Beit Din that deposed him over here and told him to step down, but rather he voluntarily did it. He stepped down until they could clarify the situation. We'll see in a second why that's important. Va'ata Eid Echad, then a single Eid came along, Vamar de Kohen Hu, or the Kohen Gamur Hu, that he's a full-fledged Kohen, Vaskinei, and therefore they reinstated him as a Kohen. Over here, the Eid Echad is successful at making him into a Kohen, because he was or has a chazakah as a Kohen. An Eid Echad versus a Kol, you see over here that the Eid Echad is sufficient or good enough to overcome the Kol, even though an Eid Echad is not sufficient to raise doubts about the issue. And again, we're going to see later on that when we have Eidim that are arguing against each other and then wiped out because they're offsetting each other, that we still give this Kohen the benefit of the doubt. Why we give him the benefit of doubt is for one of two reasons. Either because he has a chazaka that stands behind him, which is that his father was a Kohen, and at one point he was considered a kosher Kohen. So he has a chazaka as being a Kohen. So he had, at some point, we assumed that he was kosher. It was only after the rumors circulated that we started to worry about it. Given that chazaka, we can be mitzdarif, whether it's here in Eid Echad or we'll see later on, when there's a stalemate, then we give him the benefit of the doubt and he is considered a Kohen. That's one way to deal with it. The other way to deal with it is to assume here that we're only speaking about issues midrabanan, which is that when we reinstate him as a Kohen, it's only because Truma b'mzman hazeh is only midrabanan. It's only in engagements or issues by which the Kohen is acting as a Kohen that are derabanan. But had it been issues deoraita, then we would not maybe allow him to be returned as a Kohen or reinstated as a Kohen. Ba'atu Beitre, two witnesses come along, Amre de ben Grusha v'chalutzahu. They come, and now we find out the source of the rumors, because we have two Eidim testifying with certainty that he was a ben Grusha ben Chalutza. Ba'achtinei. And once again, they deposed him. They removed him from the Kihuna. So this is the second time he's being removed as a Kohen. Va'at Eid Echad. Then after that, another Eid appears, Ramar de Kohenu. And this says that he is a Kohen. Dukulei Alma mitztarfin Eidut. Everybody here agrees that the single Eid in the beginning and the single Eid in the end can be brought together, and therefore they are now two Eidim, testifying to the Kashrut or the Ichus of this individual. You know, by definition, when the Gemara makes an assumption like that, the Kulei Alma thinks this way, then the answer of the Gemara will be to say that that point is a machloket. Because afterwards, if you make that point a machloket, whatever you statement you make now is not true. But now the Gemara at this point assumes that everybody agrees that the single aid in the beginning, the single aid at the end that says kasher, can be mitzdareif. They're arguing about whether we worry about the reputation of the Beit Din, the casting of aspersions on the integrity of the Beit Din because they are changing their mind. Rabbi Elazar Savar gave in to Achtinei lo maskininle. Since we deposed him, we do not reinstate him. Chayshina leziluta de Beit Dina. We worry about the reputation of the Beit Din. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Savar anan Achtinei. We are the ones who deposed him. Anan maskininle. And therefore we're responsible to reinstate him. Leziluta de Beit Dina lo chayshina. We don't worry about the reputation of the Beit Din. We're more worried about doing the right thing. And the right thing is to make sure that this Kohen is reinstated. We were the ones who caused him the problem in the first place. We need to be the ones who rectify the problem at this point in time. So at this point in the Gemara, Rav Nachman will be relying on Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who says that we don't worry about Ziluta the Beit Din. When Beit Din reverses its position, we're not worried about that. Now once again here, what we're speaking about seemingly is a case of safek. Because if the Beit Din was certain that they were wrong and that they had made a mistake, we have plenty of Gemarot, as we're going to see in Sanhedrin and in other places, that when a Beit Din or a Psak is completely wrong, we reverse the Psak. Over here, the problem is that we have a stalemate in terms of the Eidim. We have two edim saying that he's kosher, and we have two edim saying that he's a ben grusha, ben chalutza. So as far as the edut is concerned, they offset each other. Now we have no information. The only thing that we're left with is a possibility he's a ben grusha, ben chalutza, a possibility that he is a kohen kosher. Given that, what do we do? So Rabbi Elazar says, nothing. We leave it in the status quo. We don't have any information to change our mind. We deposed him. Mitigating factor is if we reinstate him, it's going to bring problems to the integrity of the Beit Din or to the reputation of the Beit Din. So I'm better off leaving the status quo because I have no evidence to the contrary. And if I act, I actually have something that's detrimental, which is it'll hurt the Beit Din. The other hand, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, well, if you have no information and you have a safek here, go back to the original status of the Kohen. The Kohen should be reinstated to where he was before, and that was that we considered him to be kosher or b'chazakah. Again, here, this is where the question is raised. We find many places in Shas where you have a stalemate between the Edim, and nobody suggests over there that then all of a sudden he gets the original chazakah or he gets reinstated. So you have to say one of two things, which is that for a period of time he was considered a kosher Kohen, his father is a Kohen, so there is more than simply a little chazakah, there is more evidence to the fact that he should be considered or classified as a Kohen, or we're talking about Dinei Derabbanan, and that's why we allow him to be reinstated in this case. The big question that's asked by all the Rishonim over here is, didn't the Beit Din already depose him and reinstate him? In the case of the rumor, they deposed him from being a Kohen, and then they reinstated him. Now we have a second action by the Beit Din, and that's where we're saying, oh, it's questionable whether we'll allow him to be reinstated because we're worried about the integrity of the Beit Din. What about the first case? How come over there it wasn't a problem? So the Rashbam over here asks the question and suggests that these are two different types of mechanisms of being deposed. They say in the first case, it was not that the Beit Din deposed him, removed him from the kuhuna, but rather they suspended him. When the rumors arose, they didn't give a psak halacha that he's not a Kohen. They put him on administrative leave because they didn't know what to do with him at that point in time. They said, we need to investigate it further. Given that we have to investigate it further, step down in the meantime. That's not a psak halacha. Therefore, when they reinstated him, it wasn't as if they changed their mind. They simply looked into the matter and found that there wasn't an issue. Over here in the second situation, you have a psak Beit Din. Given that there's a psak Beit Din, then that's where the questions arise about the integrity of Beit Din if they're to reverse their psak without any evidence that would indicate that we should reverse it. Only the fact that now we're left to be safek and the evidence that we had before was not strong enough to depose him. So that's where the Rashbam differentiates between something that is simply suspended versus something that is a psak halacha. So the other answer, which is brought by the Balei HaTosafot, is a suggestion that he stepped down of his own volition. Not that he was deposed in any way, not that he was even asked to step down. He, of his own volition, stepped down until they could clarify the matter. If you did that, then obviously the difference between the case of the rumor and over here is significant, because Beit Din was not involved in the first case. He did it by himself. He resigned, or he took a leave of absence, or a leave without pay, and he was waiting for them to get the information so that I could reinstate him. But that's not an act of Beit Din. Since it's not an act of Beit Din, we don't have to worry about the integrity or casting aspersions on an action of Beit Din. Whereas in the second case, which is an action of Beit Din, there we do have to worry about the fact that there is Ziluta de Beit Din. All right, Matkifla Ravashi. So Ravashi then asked, Ihochi Mayiri Achad. Why do you need 1 8? Afilu betray Nami. Even with 2, it would be the same din. If you're telling us that the issue is Ziluta de Beit Din, and that's why we worry about reinstating him, then why does it matter that you have 1 8 coming back to reinstate him? Even if you had 2 Edim to reinstate him, then it wouldn't matter because you wouldn't reinstate him. The problem is not the Edut, or whether we rely on the Edut or not. The problem here is simply the integrity or reputation of Beit Din. That means that the whole case of explaining that it was 1 8 before, 1 8 afterwards, and then their mitzareif to offset the testimony of the 2 Edim, all of that seems to be extraneous or unnecessary because there's no relevance to it. The only relevance is whether we reinstate or don't reinstate. Even if you had 2 full-fledged Edim come and say he's kosher and another 2 Edim say that he is pasul, you'd be in the same predicament. Do we reinstate him or we do not reinstate him? The fact that the case is laid out in such a convoluted manner means that that must be what is triggering the machloket between Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And that's what he says, Elamar Ravashi, Dukulayama lo chayshina leziluta. Nobody worries about the ziluta, about the integrity, reputation of the Beit Din, the Beit Dina. The machloket revolves around whether the two single edim can be joined together. So now, first of all, what we did was discarded the assumption, which I said to you before. The Gemara assumed that everybody thinks two single edim can be joined together to become a single kat edim. So I said, once you do that, you can always change the machloket to be exactly that point. That's what Rav Ashi is doing. The machloket is whether those two single edim can join together to become a kat edim, to become two edim. So then, given that, everybody agrees that we don't worry about the reputation of Beit Din. That's the explanation of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says, I'm relying on Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar, who both believe we don't worry about Ziluta de Beit Din. Upluta de Hani Tanei. And this Machloket Tanaim is similar to another Machloket Tanaim that we have, the Tanya. We have a Braita. The Braita, the way that the Rashbam reads it, has two sections to it, two separate Machlokot. And the first Machloket that we're going to read has nothing to do with our Sugya. It's just brought down because it's a part and parcel of the Braita. The Olam, Ein Edutan Mitzterefet, their Edut cannot be connected together, Ad Sheyiru Shnehem Keechad, until they witness the same event. B'shuv Ben Karcho Omer, Afilu B'zeh Achar Zeh. Even if they do this sequentially, and you can see this in the Rishbam, Rishbam explains, Ad Sheyiru Shnehem Keechad, Lefuchei Achad Omer Bifanai Halvau, V'chad Omer Bifanai Hodu Olo Alav. To come to exclude a case where they saw or they have different information. One says he lent him the money in front of me. The other one says he admitted to borrowing the money. So the sum total of their testimony is that he borrowed money from this individual. But what they witnessed was different. One witnessed the actual loan. The other one witnessed him admitting to the fact that he had this loan outstanding. So since they are witnessing separate events, even though the information is the same or gets you to the same conclusion, which is that he owes money, that won't work according to the Tanakama. On the other hand, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, Erchad omer biyom rishon lava ploni mi ploni maneh, v'chad omer biyom sheni reitiv gam ani shelava mimenu. So one individual says, I saw him borrow money on Sunday. The next one says, I saw him borrow money on Monday from the same person. So again, the sum total of their testimony is that he definitely borrowed money from this individual. But they're testifying about two different incidents. And what Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, that's fine. Because the underlying information that we're seeking is, does he owe him money? Both of those events, or the witnessing of those events, mean yes, he does owe him money. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, you can be mitzdareif. These two disparate events, or these two disparate witnessings, because the sum total or the conclusion from both pieces of evidence or the witnessing of those events is the fact that he owes him money. And therefore you can be mitzareif them. The Tanakhama, on the other hand, says you need to witness the same event. It has to be that you're seeing the same event by which you are now testifying to obligate him. Doesn't mean you have to see it together. It just means you, both of you are testifying to the fact that he borrowed money on Sunday. Or you're both testifying that they borrowed money. Not that one says he borrowed money, the other one says he admitted that he borrowed money. So now that's one machloket, nothing to do with our Gemara. It's a totally separate issue about witnessing events. Then the second machloket in this braita is Ein edudan mitkayemet b'beit din ad she'idu shneim ke'achad. Here there's a machloket as to whether when they come to Beit Din, do they need to testify together. The Rabbanon or the Tanakam over here says if they come to Beit Din together, they're considered to be a kat edim. Then they're a unit of edim, they're two edim testifying. If they come to Beit Din separately, then they are separate ediot. It's one eid and one eid. One plus one does not equal two. You either come as a unit of two, or you're coming as one plus one, and it won't be two. Rabbi Natan Omer, Shumim Devarav Shalzeh Hayom, Kushiyavo Chavir Olamachar, Shumim Devarav. Rabbi Natan says, no, you can listen today to one testimony, and then another eid shows up the next day and testifies. You can join those two together, because of the fact that they are testifying about the same information, the same event, even though they didn't come together, we can bring them together, we can join their edut to make them into a single kat edim. So according to the Rashbam, there are two separate machlokot that are found in the Braita. The first one is about the witnessing of the event. What did you witness? Did you witness the same event? Or did you witness different events, even though those different events would draw the same conclusion? So that's the machlok between the Tanakam and Rabbi Shua ben Karcha. Separate machlok it is when you come to testify in court, how do you become a kat edim? Do you become a kat edim because you came together? Or can you become a kat edim because you're testifying about the same event and you are saying the same thing? And therefore we bring you together. That will be the machlok between Rabbi Lazar and Shimon Gamliel. Over here, one aid came and said he was kasher. Then two aidim came and said he was pasul. And then after that, one aid came and said he was kasher. That's exactly this case of where you testified and then another guy testified. They're testifying about the same thing, but they came at different times. Are they mitzarif to be a kat edim? Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says yes. Just like Rabbi Natan. Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Natan will be of the same opinion. You can join them together to being a kat edim. Now I have 2 versus 2. Now that I have 2 versus 2, that offsets the edim, and we return him to his chazakah, we return him to being a kohen, we reinstate him. Then Rabbi Lazar says, you have 1 plus 1, and you have 2. That doesn't work, because 1 plus 1 does not equal 2, and the 2 edim that say that he's a grusha v'chalutza, they are the ones that will trump, or they will be the ones that dictate over here, and he will have to remain deposed and not reinstated as a kohen. That's the way that the Rashbam reads it. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom over here, it seems to me that he's reading the Gemara differently, and he's reading the Braita here as being an issue that actually is raised in the Gemara in Makot, which is the following. Until both of them see as one. Shim he'id echad ani re'iti ploni love mi ploni maneh. I saw him borrowing money from so-and-so a maneh. V'achar kach he'id acher ani re'iti ploni love mi ploni maneh. Ein edutam mitzterefet. Their edut is not mitzteref. Achru beta edim kechad. Until they see together, I think this is what you were referring to, it's a sugya mleya in Makot, about whether the witnesses need to know that they are both witnessing the event together. That's what it seems that the Rabbeinu Gershom is suggesting the machloket is in the braita that's brought here. The question as to whether Achirushneim kechad means did they witness the event together? Not like the Rashbam suggested, it's a question if they saw the same event. According to the Rashbam, it doesn't matter if they saw it together. It just means, did you witness the same event or you didn't witness the same event? That's the machloket in the ratio of the Braita. Over here, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, the question is whether they actually saw it together or did they see it separately? They each witnessed the event, but they can't see each other. Are they now mitzarif to be a kat edim? That's the question in the Gemara Makot. That's what seemingly he is suggesting the machloket is over here. Do you need to witness event together to become a kat edim? Or if you witness the same event separately, are you then still a kat edim? Again, that would be a machloket that is in the Gemara Makot, but not what the Rashbam suggested over here. The Dilma, amanak de kamasid hai, lo kamasid hai. Because we have a risk, if they did not witness the event together, maybe they're discussing 2 different events. How do you know that he's talking about the same maneh that he borrowed? Maybe they are talking about 2 events, because they don't know that they saw the same event, even though they're telling us it was at the same time. Same location, but they never saw each other, so we can never be certain that they were looking at the same event. So that's what he says now. How do you know that he didn't pay it right back immediately and then borrow it again? That you could be witnessing the same event, yet not the same event. Could be that he borrowed from him twice in a very short period of time, and he paid back in the interim, and you don't know if you're talking about the same borrowing. And therefore, you need to witness together. As long as they're testifying to the same time, the same place, and the same location, we assume that they saw the same event. That's what you were suggesting. And that's what he believes. That's what Rabbi Shua ben Karcha believes. So it's clear here that the Rabbeinu Gershom sees this very differently than the Rashbam. The Rashbam's question about Shneim Kechad or Bezech HaZeh means, did you witness the same event? Or is your testimony coming from witnessing 2 different events? Over here, the Rabbeinu Gershom says, everybody agrees they witnessed the same event. It's a question if they knew that they were witnessing the same event. Were they clear that they both were seeing the same thing? Or maybe they never saw each other, so we don't know. Even though they're giving testimony to the same time, place, and location, maybe they were seeing 2 different events. So that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom learns it. And therefore, the second part of the Braita would be a derivative of the first part, which is that the first part is speaking about, did we witness it together, or did we witness it separately? Then, when you come into Beit Din, then that would be a continuation of the case. How does a Kat Edim become a Kat Edim? Do you need to witness it together in order to be a Kat Edim? Or is coming and testifying together what generates the fact that you are a Kat Edim? And that's what the second machlok would be about is, that until they testify together in Beit Din, they will not be classified as an Edut Achat. So now you could have a difference. Do you need to witness it together or just testify together? And then along comes Rabbi Natan and says, well, even if they don't testify together, they can be classified as a single Edut. So it's not clear, based on the Rabbeinu Gershom, whether in the second half of the Braita, are they now clarifying the position of the Chachamim, who say that you must see it together? Are they clarifying the position of Yeshua ben Karcha, that says, even if they don't witness it together, but they saw the same event, they're considered to be an Edut Achat? And then Rabbi Natan comes along to say, that's even if they don't testify together. And the Chachamim say, no, only if they testify together can they be considered a Kat Achat. They said it's similar to benching in some ways. The Rishonim argue with regards to mizuman by benching, what classifies you as a mizuman? Does it mean that you sat down to eat the meal together? That's what makes you into a mizuman. Or does it mean that you finished the meal together? That's what makes you into a mizuman. So, same thing over here. The question of what makes you into a kat edim? Is it that you witness it together? Is it that you came and gave hagadat edut together? Or maybe neither of those are necessary in order to be hagadat edut. As long as you testify to the same event, and you come to Beit Din, by definition, we're going to join your testimonies together. So that brings us to the conclusion that Reb Nachman had Tanaim on which to hang his hat. And that is that we don't worry about Ziluta the Beit Din. We allow the Beit Din to reverse their position when you come into a Safek. Had they Patskin based on the information originally from two Edim, now they get two other Edim that don't necessarily give them a conclusive Psak, but simply cast aspersions or questions on the first set of Edim, because now they have offsetting Edim. In that case, it's a fake. What do we do? Rava says, we don't do anything. We leave it the way it is, because we worry about the reputation of Beit Din. Rav Nachman says, no, we reverse the position. We go back to the original status because of the fact that we don't have the information that allowed us to make the first psak. That information was incorrect, because now we have offsetting Edut, and we return it back to the state prior to that. Even though it will maybe hurt the reputation of Beit Din, I think in some ways he's arguing that that is probably to the benefit of the reputation of Beit Din, because we worry about the integrity, reputation, and the way people view the Beit Din, and if they're going to reverse their positions, people will question it. But in some sense, if they know that the Beit Din's honest, that when they get the information, they do reverse their position, that might in itself prevent this problem of Ziluta de Beit Din. He never says that. But I think that could be behind Rav Nachman's position as well. Okay, now next case. What are you doing in this property? I bought it from you. And here is the document of sale. It is a false contract. It is a forgery, the contract. Gochin, he bent over. He whispered into Rabba's ear. In Shtara Zayfahu, he is right. It is a forgery, the contract. Miu, Shtara Ma'al Yahavali. I did have a proper contract for the sale. Ve'irkas, and it was ripped up, it got lost, it was burnt, something happened to it. Ve'amina, and I said, Inkit Hai Biyadai, Koldu, let me at least have this forged document by which I can then bring that as evidence. And at least that will keep me intact here, despite the fact that it's not a real contract. Amar Rabba, Rabba says about this, Malo L'Shaker, what is it worth lying for him? Why would he lie in this case? Tell us that the shtar is mizuyaf, that it is a forgery, and then go on to tell this whole story about the fact that he had a real shtar. If he wanted to lie, he should have just said, this shtar is a good shtar, and he would have been fine, he would have won the case. So the fact that he provides us all this information, we should believe him, because if he wanted to lie, he had a much better lie. He could have just said, it's a great shtar. This shtar was fine. It was nothing compelling him to admit to the fact that this was a forgery. Amalei Rav Yosef, so Rabba's peer Rav Yosef says, Amai samachta haishtara, haishtara chasvu ba'almu. How can you rely on the shtar that he claimed originally was the evidence to the fact that he purchased the property? That shtar is chasvu ba'almu. That is a piece of paper, it's a piece, a shard of pottery. It is worthless. This shtar has no meaning in the case. All right, so now let's break down the two sides here in terms of the case. First of all, the Rashbam points out that the girsa over here is Rabba, because we know that Rabba and Rav Yosef were competing to be the Rosh Yeshiva. In the end, Rav Yosef deferred to Rabba. We know that at the end of Gemara and Brachot, and Rabba was the Rosh Yeshiva for 22 years before Rav Yosef became the Rosh Yeshiva. Because Rav Yosef knew that once he became Rosh Yeshiva, his life was very limited, that he was going to pass away after that happened. So he deferred to Rabbah. So that's why the case here is a case of Rabbah giving a Psak Halacha. And Rav Yosef, who was not the Rosh Yeshiva, but was a peer of his, was questioning the Psak that he gave. So that's the first of all, just as the background to why the case is laid out like this. Number two, what does Rabbah mean, Malul L'Shakir? What happened here? What exactly was the shtar? If this shtar is really a forgery, then in the end, we're going to discover the forgery, and the person won't be able to make a claim. How can you say Malul L'Shakir? Therefore, the Rashbam here brings down three different interpretations as to what it means that he admitted this shtar was a forgery. It says, Perush Rabbeinu Chananel. First Perush he brings down is, Lav Shtara Zaifa Mamash. It's not a real forgery. Ela kamo shtara zaifa shelo nichtav al mechira zo. It's equivalent of a forgery because it wasn't written about this sale. Umaynihu shtar amana duhu batel. It was a shtar that was written, here shtar amana, or other types of shtarot that are written but not meant to be used or not meant to be documented. They were shtar amana is a case where the person uses the shtar to show something or demonstrate something, but not that the event really took place or happened. So the shtar was not written because there was a real sale. Shtar was written for whatever reasons, and they were maybe justified or there was some truth to the shtar when it was written, but it was never meant as a shtar of evidence. It was never meant as a shtar to show that there was a sale over here. It had other purposes. It was meant for something else. So it's the shtar itself is not a forgery in the sense that somebody forged the whole shtar and signed the signatures in a forged manner, but rather it was a fully signed shtar, but it was not meant to be a shtar to be utilized. And that's why he calls it Zaifa. That's what the Rabbeinu Chananel says, because if he admits completely that it was a shtar mizuyaf, then you have a real problem, because at that point, the shtar here will be found out, or they're going to figure out that there's a problem with the shtar. As soon as he does that, you can't say Malul L'Shakir. Malul L'Shakir only works if you have two possible ways you could have gone. One possible way is to say the shtar is good. The other possible way is to say the shtar is a forgery, but I had a real shtar. If both of those options are open to him, then you could say Malul L'Shakir. If one of those two options gets closed down, there's no longer Malul L'Shakir. So if it was a real forgery and the shtar would not be validated and baked in, then there's no way you can say Malul L'Shakir. He had no option to use this shtar as the vehicle for collection because it would have been found out it to be a forgery, and he wouldn't be able to collect. The next way the Rashbam explains it is, Inami, Ika Lefrushe, Zaifa Shtar Mizuyaf Mamash. It was a complete forgery, the shtar. It's such a good forgery that when the Edim see their signatures, they think it is their own signature. And they testify to that fact. So here he could have gotten the document validated because the Edim would come and testify and say that it was their signature. So that's the next one possibility. It is a real forgery, but such a good forgery that it would have stood up in court and he would have been able to use that document to collect with. So that's a way that he gets over the problem. The third way, he says, is Inami matzi l'kaimo be'edim shkarim shechad nulo. Says that possibility it was a forgery, and despite the fact that maybe the forgery would have been discovered, he could bring in false witnesses to testify that they recognized the signatures on the document, and then he could uphold it in Beitin. Because in the end, he has to validate this contract. How does he validate the contract? So if you say that it was a shtar that was written properly, and it was meant to be a shtar, just not for this purpose, then it's easy to understand. Either it might have been validated already, or he could get it validated because it looks real and the signatures are real. That's Rabbeinu Chananel's view. The Rashbam brings two other possibilities as to how that could happen, despite the fact that it's a real forgery. Either the forgery is so good that it would trick the signatories to thinking it was their own signature, or he could bring in false witnesses to testify. So there's three different ways that it could have been that the shtar would have been upheld in court or validated in court. That's the Rashbam's explanation. And then, what about Rabbi Yosef's question? Rabbi Yosef says, you can't say Malul L'Shakir over here because the shtar itself is worthless. So this is what we said before, it's called Amigo B'Makom Edim. So now, Amigo B'Makom Edim, according to the Rashbam, Amigo B'Makom Edim means that your original claim falls by the wayside. You can only say Amigo where I have a claim, and then I had a better claim. And since I didn't use the better claim, but used the worst claim, I'm believed, because if I wanted to lie, I would have lied in a better way. But the Rashbam says that's only true when your underlying claim remains intact. We saw that yesterday, that when the underlying claim is taken away, for instance, when the two Edim show up and say that it belonged to the other person's forefathers, then you took away the option of his claim. That's what the Rashbam says, is that the Tana disappears, and now it's a Chazakah without a Tana. And same thing over here. This person's in the property. He had a Tana that he has a Shtar. Once you determine that the Shtar is a false Shtar, given the fact that he admitted that it was a false Shtar, the Rashbam says that Odat Badin Kamei Edim, once he admits to the fact that it's a Shtar Pasul, he's now ruined his Tana. Once he's ruined his Tana, the original Tana at least, then you can't do anything anymore. That becomes a Migo B'Makom Edim, and now we can't say, well, he had two options, he could have gone this way, that way. He ruined the original statement. His original claim must remain intact, according to the Rashbam, in order for there to be a Migo. As soon as you ruin the original claim, you can't say, well, he could have had this other claim. The fact is that the original claim is now removed. Given that, it's a Migo B'Makom Edim. And that's what he says here as well. This is considered to be a Migo B'Makom Edim because the fact that he now admits the fact that the Shtar is a forgery, that's the equivalent of Edim coming along and taking away his claim. His admitting to the fact that it's false takes away his original claim that this was a good Shtar. Once he's done that, there's no Migo left. That's the way the Rashbam reads it. The Balei HaTosfot and other Rishonim believe that Migo B'Makom Edim is the fact that you don't have enough Nemanut with your Migo to overcome the testimony of Edim. When there are Edim there, your Migo is enough to establish you're telling the truth when there's no mitigating force, when there's nothing else that makes us think otherwise. When you have Edim that come along and say otherwise, and now you want to use the Migo is not strong enough then to overcome the Edim. So over here, the problem then can't be an issue of Migo because there are no Edim in this case. There's no Edim. It's just his admission that the Shtar was a Shtar Mizuyaf. So what you have to say according to Rav Yosef is one of a number of possibilities. Either the Shtar was not Mikuyam. The Shtar was yet to be validated in Beit Din. And therefore, now that he's admitted that it is a forgery, we never will be able to validate it in Beit Din. So since he never brought a Shtar that was at the point that it was collectible because it was not validated, and now his admission to the fact that it's a forgery will not allow us to validate it. Once you do that, he has, what Rabbi Yosef says, chaspa v'alma. He's walking around with something that has no validity to it. If he has no validity to it, you can't say malo l'shaker because he doesn't have a claim to start with. There's no right of collection anymore. He's taken away his one piece of evidence, is gone. In essence, he has no evidence whatsoever to the claim. It's not migo b'makom edim. That's the way the Rashbam reads that type of lack of evidence. But just there's a pure lack of evidence whatsoever because he can't validate the contract. The other possibility is that we can only say malo l'shaker when the individual told the truth in the first place. If he told the truth in the first place, then we could say if he wanted to lie, he would have lied better. But if we figure out that his original claim is a lie, then how can you say lo malo l'shaker? The whole problem is that he's lying to start with. He came with a lie to try to establish his position. So then you can't say malo l'shaker if he's already lying about the original position. So for those reasons, Rabbi Yosef says you cannot collect based on this. So now next case. Hoda amar l'chavrei, habli li me'ezuzei de mesikna b'cha. This individual says, give me the 100 zuz that you owe me. I'd like you to collect them. B'hashtara. And here is the document evidencing the fact that there is this outstanding loan or that you owe me the money. Amalei shtara zayfahu. The individual said it was a forgery, the document. The defendant says that it was a forgery. Gochin lochish le derabba, exact same case or similar case. He bent over and whispers into Rabba's ear, in shtar zayfa, it is a forgery. Miu shtar mal yahavali virkas. I had a proper shtar, but it was lost, ripped up. Something happened to it. Vamina in kadhai biyadai koldu. Let me keep this contract at least so that it would provide evidence to me even though it's a forgery. Amar Rabba, malo l'shaker. Again, Rabba gives the same psak he gave before. Malo l'shaker, he should be believed. He could have just said the forgery is a good shtar, and he would have collected based on that. So now that he didn't do that, and he's telling us what seemingly is the truth, we're going to believe him. Ibai amar lei shtar malu, because he could have said it was a valid shtar. Now he's got to assume he's telling us the truth, because there's no reason for him to do this. If he wanted to lie, the better lie would have just to say this is a good shtar. Now that he's admitting it's a forgery and saying that there was a real shtar, we should believe him. How can you rely on this shtar? This shtar is completely worthless. It's a shard of pottery. It has no meaning to it. Again, the same things that we said before, whether it's Migo B'Makom Edim, according to the Rashbam, According to the other views, there is no claim left over here, or the fact that you're not telling the truth. To start with, you can't have malo l'shaker when you're not speaking the truth. For all those reasons, Rav Yosef believes otherwise. Of course, the question is, why do you bring two cases down? These are the exact same case, same psak from Rabban Rav Yosef. Why do you need both of them? The answer is that they're different cases. One of them deals with karka, and one of them deals with mamon. The first case was a property case. The second case was a metaltalin, was a monetary case. For that reason, Amar Rav Yidi Barabin, Hilchata Kavate de Rabba, Ba'aro. The aloha is like Rabba when it comes to land. Hilchata Kavate de Yosef Bezuze. And the law is like Rav Yosef when it comes to the case of the Zuzeh. So he bifurcates the din and says the din is different by land than it is by the money. The law is like Rabba by Ara, because wherever it was found, it should remain. Wherever the money is, it should remain. The way that Rashbam reads this is that we have a safek in the psak. We don't know whether we should be paskining like Rabba or paskining like Rav Yosef. They both have good positions over here. We don't know which is the right position. Now that we're left in Makom Safek, what do? We say, Amotzi mi chaveiro ala baraya. So we have to look at where the property or the item is muhzak, and then it will remain in that status. So what we say, according to the Rashbam, is the property was in the hands of the one holding the shtar right now. He was living in it. He was holding the property. He's the muhzak in the property. Given that he's the mukzak in the property, and we don't know what to do, we have a safek in the psak, therefore, we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt, and if you want to come and remove the property for him, the guy who's claiming that this whole thing's a forgery, he's got to prove or give evidence to the contrary. In the case of the money, the person who has the money right now is the supposed borrower. The lender, or the supposed lender, is asking him to pay money out. So now that I'm left a bit safek, I leave the money bechezkato, which is with the supposed borrower. And if the lender, or supposed lender, wants his money, he's motzi mechavero alav araya. So that's the way the Rashbam reads it. That Rav Yidi Barabin had a safek in the psak. Given that he had a safek in the psak, he came to two different conclusions. Not because the halacha is like Rabba over here, and not because the halacha is like Rav Yosef over there, but rather the halacha of Rabba ends up leaving it with the person who's mukzak. And the halacha of Rav Yosef, in the other case, leaves it with the person that is mukzak. So in essence, what he's saying is, we don't know what to do, so we just leave it with the person who has it right now. That's what the Rashbam says. The Balei Tosafot are bothered by the explanation of the Rashbam for a number of reasons. One of which is, the way that it is phrased in the Gemara is, halacha k'rabba like this, and halacha k'rab Yosef like this. The truth is that the halacha is like neither of them. It's not that the halacha is like Rabba or Rav Yosef, it just turns out that we will follow the conclusion of their din, but not for their reason. It's a safek. It has to do with Motzi Mechaber Ol Araya, but we're not paskening like Rabba, we're not paskening like Rav Yosef. So that's one issue. The second issue is that generally, when it comes to Rabba and Rav Yosef, we have a principle throughout Shas, Rabba and Rav Yosef, Halacha Rabba, Chutz, and there are three exceptions when we do pasken like Rav Yosef. So again, why is Rabba Yidi Ba'avin over here all of a sudden have a safek about the psah? In general, when it comes to Rabba and Rav Yosef, we paskin like Rabba. So why do you have a safek about the psak? Tosafot points out that if we really return it to the one who was mukzak in it, then the marakama, the original owner, should be the one who's classified as mukzak in it. That's what we say in other cases, that the person who has the chazaka is the original owner. The person trying to change the status quo is the person who purchased the property. So if you were, like the Rashbam says, going to go back to whoever was mukzak in the property, then you should have gone back to the original owner and not leave it here with the person who had purchased it. Whereas those that counter in defense of the Rashbam suggest that over here the shtar was not completely mizuyaf, but rather the shtar, as Rabbeinu Hananel said, was a shtar amana, which is indicative of the fact that there was some relationship between these parties, or maybe even an intention to sell the property to this party, even though this document itself is not the document of sale. So given that evidence, it changes who's mukzak in the property and makes the party that is currently in the property the mukzak in the property and not the original owner. So that's how the Rashbam would answer that question of the Balei Tosafot. For that reason, that Balei Tosafot over here think that when the Gemara says halacha k'rabba and halacha k'rab Yosef, it's not mi b'chinat safek. It's mi b'chinat, that is the psak halacha. And the reason being, according to the Balei Tosafot, is that we're speaking about amigo over here. And what the Balei Tosafot suggest over here, it's not muskam l'chol rishonim. It happens to be a major machloket in the rishonim. But the Balei Tosafot used this before. I'll explain to you in a second. They used it before. And they use it again here, which is that amigo is only sufficient evidence to keep the status quo intact. Amigo is not a strong enough piece of evidence to change what is now the status quo. Basically what he says is, ain't amigo lo hotzi mamon. You can't use amigo to cause money to change hands or to make a claim and collect on that claim. You can use amigo as a defense to say that I should be believed in my defense. So that's what happens over here. In the case of the Ara, in the case of the Karka, the claimant is the original owner of the land. The defendant over here is the person who is now on the land. So now when you invoke the Migo, his Migo is defending his position, defending his right to stay on the land. That's a Migo in defense. It's not a Migo Lohotzi. There the Migo is good enough, and that's why we pass them like Rabba. In the case of the money and the lending the money, he wants to use the Migo in order to take money away from someone else, Lohotzi Mamon. He's trying to collect money based on his Migo. That we won't do. We won't invoke a Migo to Hotzi Mamon. And that's why the Locha is like Rav Yosef over there, because the Migo doesn't work. That's how the Baal Yad Tosafot explained this difference in Psak Halacha between Rav and Rav Yosef, which is it's the nature of a Migo. A Migo is strong enough to maintain the status quo, to defend your position. It's not strong enough to Hotzi Mamon. And that's how the Baal Yad Tosafot explained it. That also explains why the Baal Yad Tosafot before asked the question, which is, Tema, Tehemene Mimigo, why don't we believe the individual, Dibay Amar Shtar Ma'al Yehu? He could have just claimed that it was a great star, and therefore we should believe him Mimigo. V'teretz Ribar Mordechai, Dolo Amrin Amigo Lotzi Mamon. We don't use Amigo in order to collect money. So that was the question that he asked in Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef, why doesn't Rav Yosef hold of this Migo? It's a good Migo. The answer is it's a Migo Lotzi. And Rav Yosef does not subscribe to that. You cannot be motzi mamon or yidei migo. V'lo amrino migo ala hakzik mamon. You only can use a migo to keep the status quo. Sheyachol liftor atzmo yidei migo. That can leave you as a being patur. It cannot collect money. Inami. And yeshlo shtaro chazaka. V'zeh ba lifsol rayato. Az yachol l'kaimo yidei migo. The other possibility is that if you have a shtar or a chazaka, and someone wants to challenge the proof that you have, you can use a Migo to uphold your proof. So that's another way, that Migo is only good enough to reinforce other evidence that you have. So for instance, you have a Chazaka. So now you can use the Migo together with the Chazaka in order to maintain things. Or you have a Migo and a Shtar. Those two things together can work. And what Rav Yosef is suggesting over here is that the Migo over here doesn't work because it's not supporting anything. The Shtar, you figured out, was a Shtar that was a forgery. It's a false star. So over here, the Migo is not going to help you because you don't have anything to uphold. The Migo is not providing additional evidence to something that you have. You don't have anything. So then the Migo is not helpful. So that's the other way the Baal Yad Tosafot would explain it. He says, V'ein niradarim idiloma ferish time hochi behedjo. He says, that's too strong an issue because if that is why Rav Yosef really thinks that that's the case, then it should have been more explicit. And then, Venir of the Reed, the time of Rabbi Yosef, I mean, amigo hacha, kem lately hacha, amigo. Shutzrakla shakir tchilav lomar, vahashtara. Inami, mishum hachilo, I mean, an hacha, amigo, mishum davi choser vitoin. So then the Baal Yad Tosafot bring two other reasons why Rabbi Yosef thinks it's not a good amigo over here. Either we don't say amigo over here, the lately hacha, amigo, and the imkain shakar tchila. That's what we discussed before, that the amigo here is premised on him lying up front. If you lie up front, then you can't say malo l'shakir, because he already was b'shakir. So then you can't do Malashakir. Or the other reason is, he's changing his mind. Which is that what we saw before, that you're allowed to change your testimony as long as it's only an alteration or a reinterpretation of what you said, a clarification of what you said before. Over here, he's completely changing his claim. And when he completely changes his claim, the Migo falls away. So here, the Baal Yad Tosafot will give you four reasons why this Migo is not working according to Rabbi Yosef. And that's why he says in the end, the Gemara paskins, like Rabbi Yosef, in the case of the money, not in the case of the karka, because we can't have a migo to hotzi, but you can have a migo to keep the status quo, or the chazik mamon, to keep the property or the money where it is. Now Gemara says, next case, how arva, the amar le lelove, this guarantor that goes to the borrower, and says, Avli me'ezuze de parati le malve, le vach. Please pay me back the money that I paid on your behalf to the lender. On your behalf, I paid back the loan because I was the guarantor, but now you owe me the money. Please pay me. Vahashtara. And here is the shtar. Now, the way that the Rashbam explains it is that the malve, the lender gave the shtar to the arev after the arev paid the malveh for the money. So he paid him the money, and then he went over. He went over to the loveh. Now, this seems to be a case, as the Rashbam points out, which is, it's called an arev kablan. In general, the principle in halacha is you may not go after the guarantor until the borrower defaults. The malveh, the lender, must go to the borrower first, and only after default can he go to the arev. But there is something called an arev kablan, which is that you either were the intermediary, the lender gave the money to the guarantor, and then the guarantor gave the money to the borrower. Or in essence, he became the middleman, but that means that the loan is really outstanding with the guarantor, and then the borrower took it from him. Or written in the shtar is the ability of the malveh to go to either party, which is that I can go to the borrower or to the guarantor, whoever I choose to go to, I can make that decision. And that's what he did here. He went to the arev first. So he was entitled, for whatever reason, whether he was an arev kablan, whether he was had that option in the contract, he had a right to go to the arev, and he exercised that right and collected the money from him. The arev now shows up and says to the borrower, you owe me the money, and here is the shtar evidencing the loan, and that I am the guarantor. And seemingly they might have written something and now into the contract, which says that the arev paid on behalf of the borrower, so there is evidence of the fact that he owes him the money. Amalei la paraticha, didn't I already pay you back? The borrower says to the guarantor, I already paid you back for laying out the money for me. So amalei la hadar shakotinu minai, didn't you re-borrow it after the fact? So he says to him, yes, you repaid it, but then you borrowed it back from me. Now the borrower over here doesn't admit anything, doesn't say anything. Shalcha ravidi ba'avin, the kameidu abaye. Ravidi ba'avin was adjudicating this case, and he sent to abaye to say, what do I do? How do I pass in here? Shalach le abaye, mighty bayali. Why are you, what's your question over here? Hi, ihu damar, aren't you the one who said, hilchata kadabe de rabo ba'ara, the hilchata kavate de riosef is zuze? That the loch is like rabo by land, and the loch is like rabbi yosef by zuze. Teichad ukma zuze, lukma, wherever the money is, that's where it will stay. That's where it sits. According to Rashbam, you have a safek in the psak, you leave the money with the person who's holding it, and that is the borrower over here. On the other hand, according to the Balei Tosafot, you have a migo here. The migo is that he could have just said that you never paid me back. Instead, he admitted that he paid him back, and he re-lent him the money. So now he has a migo. Does the migo work? So according to the Balei Tosafot, a migo lahotzi doesn't work. The arev can't take money away from the borrower with a migo. So therefore, the migo is not helpful over here. You're passing like Rav Yosef by Zuzay, the money should stay with the borrower. And you're the one who said this. You're the one who said the loch is like Rav Yosef in that case. Mar says, or qualifies that, and says, V'ani mile damale hadart ozvtinu minai. That he says, you re-borrowed it from me. Aval amarle hadratinu ni alach. If he says that, I returned it to you, machmat avu shayfi v'sumke, because there was a problem with the coinage, akati itale shibude de shtora. Then the shibud, or the lien, that's in the shtar, embedded in the shtar, still exists. What the Gemara is pointing out is what you just asked, which is, if he repaid the money, and then relent him the money, it's a totally different case. The original shtar now is meaningless in that context, because the original shtar was paid back, and once you pay back the money, the shibud disappears. It cancels the shtar. If you relent money under a used shtar, it's not a shtar for the shibud in it. The shibud is already machul, and you can't use the original document to now relend under that document. It gives you no rights. And that's what he's saying over here. If the case was that he got repaid, and then he relent the money, you're right. In that case, he has no claim here because the shtar is an invalid shtar. And given that, he has no rights of collection. We don't say malul l'shaker, all the claims that Rav Yosef had before. But if he accepted the repayment, but he said, I returned you the money because the money that you used was unacceptable. That is because it was shayfei v'sumke. The way the Rashbam explains it is, shayfei means it was worn down. The images on the coins were already worn down to the point that he didn't feel it was good coinage. Or sumke is red. The copper oxidized and turned red. Can't see the copper. The Rabbeinu Gershom over here to suggest that it's one thing. Shayfei v'sumke, which is that it was enwrapped in something. There was something around it, and you had to rub it away to get to the coin. But he felt that those weren't good quality coins that were buried underneath whatever this covering or this red film that was on top of the coin. He had to rub it down. He didn't want those coins, and he returned it. Now, by returning the money and not accepting it as payment means that the shtar was never repaid. The loan was never repaid. So then it's still outstanding, and then he has a shibud. And if the shibud of the shtar is still outstanding, then that is good enough to make a collection. All right, we're going to stop here. Four lines from the bottom. Alamed bet, amud bet.